Okay. We're going to get rolling right now because we only have an hour and we're going to move right to it. We have three great speakers on the subject of employment and labor. I'm Rich Wolf from USA Today. I cover the court. I've covered the White House and the Congress in the past, so I'm on my third branch, and this is June, so there's not much going on at the court, and I figured I'd be here. We have 23 decisions to go in about 2.5 weeks. The lineup here, and we'll go in this order, I think, is Caroline Fredrickson, President of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. I'm going to be brief in these. There are bios in the back. Peter Schomber is a former chairman and board member of the National Labor Relations Board, and Tuan Samahan is professor of law at Villanova University School of Law, teaches advanced separation of powers, constitutional law, and federal courts. I know there's going to be some level of disagreement here, which is a good thing, and we'll give each speaker 5, 6, 7 minutes, whatever they need, and we'll go to questions and have plenty of time for questions. So Caroline, you want to go first?
Sure. It's nice to be invited to speak to all of you. You may know the American Constitution Society is the counterpart to the Federalist Society on the left. We are always happy to have members of the Federalist Society speak at our events. And indeed, we have our convention starting on Thursday, and we'll have a number of your colleagues who will be joining us there. I'm a little bit of the ringer here in some ways, because this is I've never sat on the National Labor Relations Board. I did practice labor law a million years ago, once when I first came to Washington, union side labor law. So I'm going to speak just very generally. I think the Obama administration has been trying very hard to actually make the laws that exist enforceable. I think where we are right now is a situation where there are seems to me the fundamental problem is that conservatives, Republicans in the Senate particularly, don't support the National Labor Relations Act or the Title VII or many of our environmental protection laws, rather though than trying to directly repeal those laws with which they disagree, they're indirectly trying to do a number of things. The most obvious is defunding agencies, defunding enforcement budgets, but I think the one that we've seen most recently and most in the news is the very, very, unprecedented obstruction of executive branch appointees. When you have the congruence of the filibuster, the Supreme Court ruling that the National Labor Relations Board has to function with three in order to have a quorum to make its rulings enforceable, a very, very a court that's the D.C. Circuit that's very biased towards the right and against the board. I think we have a situation where the law has just become null, null and void. Nullification seems to be the major strategy on the right. I think we should just bring this debate out into the open. Let's debate whether or not we should have a National Labor Relations Act. I think that would be a lot more direct. I think it would be a lot fairer to our democracy and the American public that elected Barack Obama. I think most of us probably think elections count, and that executive branch and agency appointments should be given to the president within reasonable constitutional frame. But that's not where we are. I think I'm happy to have a discussion with my colleagues up here. I've met quite a number of points where we will disagree. There may be some points where we agree. I certainly hope so. But I think there's a level of frustration now. This is just representative of one area of the law, but where the American public finds our entire government to be dysfunctional, the Senate in particular, which is really one of the places where most of these problems have arisen. So with that, I will turn it over to Peter.
I'm delighted to be here. I'm taking Pete Kersenow's place. He's a hard shoes to fill, but we thoroughly enjoyed each other's company at the National Labor Relations Board. Wilma Liebman, she was at my house for a Christmas party just before we became a two-member board back in 2008 and maybe 2009, And she'd been there for a while. I didn't see her, and she came up to me, and she looked at me. She was kind of stern. She said, "Whatever happened to you?" I said, "What do you mean, whatever happened to me?" She said, "You have so many right-thinking friends here." Well, having lived in Washington for many years, we have a lot of Democrat and liberal friends, and she was shocked that I was as conservative as I am. I don't think the issue is that the Republicans are opposed to the National Labor Relations Act. I think the issue is whether or not we're following the National Labor Relations Act. The short answer to the question is the Wagner Act was not Congress's last word on the issue. The Wagner Act was passed in response to the abuses of management power. The Taft-Hartley Act was passed in responses to abuses of union power. You recall, under the Wagner Act, workers didn't have a right to refrain. Employers had no right to express their opposition to unionization. There were no union unfair labor practices. Taft-Hartley changed all of that. Archibald Cox said it was a fundamental change in philosophy. The Supreme Court has said that the act is now wholly neutral on the question of unionization. And that's where the rubber hits the road, because this board has not been wholly neutral on the question of unionization. In fact, in all candor, Wilma Liebman publicly said that the board doesn't have to be neutral on the question of unionization. What the board does, and what the Democrat side on the board does, they look at the language in the preamble to the statute, which was retained in Taft-Hartley. And was not changed, which says to promote the practice and procedure of collective bargaining. And they use that to trump the specific provisions of Taft-Hartley and specific provisions of the Act. And that is what's been happening. You can look throughout a variety of different board decisions. I don't mean to take advantage of Caroline, and she may or may not be familiar with some of these, but let's look at a few of them. The Obama board stripped workers of their rights to challenge a union recognition based on an unreliable card check. Their reasoning was that although the union lost 25% of the challenges, there weren't a sufficient number of challenges to warrant a delay in collective bargaining. It gave unions the green light to engage in secondary boycotts. Secondary boycotts are outlawed by the Taft-Hartley Act. But what it did is that picketing was always deemed to be inherently coercive. And the Act prescribes conduct that threatens, coerces, or restrains. So they redefined picketing. Picketing's definition had been arrived at by boards controlled by Democrats and Republicans over the years. It was a very broad definition. It was affirmed by the circuit courts. A picket in a snowbank was deemed to be picketing. Well, the board, in a case, the Obama board, decided that you had to have traditional picketing, which meant you had to hold picket signs on a wooden stick, perhaps they would permit steel. You had to walk in an elliptical pattern for that to be inherently coercive. They also required that there wasn't traditional picketing, that the employer would have to prove that its business was threatened or actually interrupted. The Act specifically states that it is only the conduct, not necessarily the result, it's only the conduct and the reason for the conduct that is prescribed. That is, you engage in conduct which is coercive for a secondary object, directly contrary to the Act. It has sought to limit employer speech. It gave partial effect to a New York State neutrality statute, which although it said it presumed to be preempted by the statute, it said that the employer had engaged in a, quote, sufficient anti-union campaign, so we're not going to set the election aside. There was uncontradicted evidence that the employer limited its anti-union campaign because of the New York statute. You're all familiar with the quickie election rule. I won't spend too much time on that, but that, too, is directly contrary to the statute. The statute requires an appropriate hearing prior to an election with board review. They kind of sidestepped it. They limited the number of issues that could be brought before the hearing officer, and then they essentially said there would be no board review until after the election. The rule was arbitrary and capricious. Many of these issues, which were normally heard prior to the election, determined whether or not the election should be had at all, whether a voter is qualified, whether the unit is an appropriate one. One could go on, and I don't want to belabor the point, but for me, probably the most disturbing element of the Obama board has been its imperious disdain for process and for the obligation of a government entity to be open, frank, and honest with regard to what it's doing. For example, in the specialty healthcare decision, it stated that it was based on long-standing board law and circuit court precedent. It's simply not consistent with the facts. It is not. It was a fundamental change in how the board decides what's an appropriate unit. Essentially, what the board was trying to do, something fairly consistent with Craig Becker's philosophy, which he believes in minority bargaining, essentially was saying it's easier for a union to organize two people or four people than it is 40, so we're going to redefine how we decide what's an appropriate unit, and any two or more people doing the same job in the same location could be an appropriate unit. I mentioned the name Craig Becker, and I think this brings up in the kind of in response to what Caroline has said. I think President Obama gave a message to the board, as he did to other executive branch agencies. We begin with the crisis of the Crandown, but with regard to the board itself, he nominated Craig Becker. Craig Becker is the first person to come to the board directly from a labor union. That was considered disqualifying until the Obama administration. To its credit, the AFL-CIO, decades ago, objected to union and management side labor lawyers from private practice serving on the board. Now, for the first time, we have people coming directly from organized labor. Wilma Liebman, who worked for a union, first had to go through what was referred to as a period of detoxification. And she worked on Capitol Hill. But that's the way board members were selected until this administration. So the board has made radical changes in prior board law. This has been settled law, affirmed by circuit courts. Republicans are not opposed to the National Labor Relations Act. They want the National Labor Relations Act to be followed. It's talked about the obstruction of nominees. Craig Becker was filibustered for views considered outside the mainstream. It'd be difficult to say that his views were not outside the mainstream. With regard to Sharon Block and Richard Griffin, they weren't nominated until December, just before the Senate went out for, I don't want to say Christmas recess, maybe Christmas break. And they were recessed 18 days later. The argument that was made was, we have to do this because you're obstructing nominees. The fact of the matter, Terry Flynn had been pending for a year. He could easily have been confirmed. All his paperwork had been submitted. Sharon Block and Richard Griffin were recess appointed before the Senate even received their paperwork. So I respectfully disagree with the colleague, and pass the baton.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Carolyn. So I am on the panel as the non-labor law person because there's not much about labor law that I could say. Let me just address one remark in particular that Carolyn made, which concerned the National Labor Relations Act generally as an organic act, and the fact that Republicans have engaged in, and I'll grant you, obstruction. The question then is whether that is a flaw or a feature, and I would submit that it is a feature in that there are two questions. One, whether the agency is to exist, and then second, who is to staff it. And those are separate questions, and I think it entirely within the domain of Congress to decide who staffs it. Now, what happens with the fact that statutes might be disused over time? That is, if the National Labor Relations Act at one point in time was viewed as useful and necessary, and one of the major parties comes to dislike the way that it's interpreted or not interpreted as it might be, is it right to then block appointments as a means of guiding the interpretation of the statute? And I think the answer must be yes, and I'll give you this reason, and I'll appeal to Greek mythology for this, and is the idea of the myth of Tithonus. And so the idea is that Tithonus is lover of Eos, and Eos says, Tithonus, I Zeus, please give Tithonus, my lover, eternal life. Right? And so Tithonus is granted eternal life, but she forgot to ask, and Zeus, being mischievous because she had forgotten to ask it, did not ask for eternal youth for her lover. And so Tithonus ages and becomes this, whining bag of bones as he's decrepit and on the floor. And so by analogy, I might suggest that there's a certain statutory asymmetry, that it is much harder to repeal or amend laws once they are in life than it is to, say, create them in the first place. And so to the extent that NLRA is a little bit like EOS's bag of bones lover, that perhaps then it makes sense to think about trying to direct the agency through the appointment process. Now, on this question of whether this is a flaw, as Caroline sees it, or a feature, as I might characterize it, I talk about this metaphor of gridlock that is often used. Now, I think we choose metaphors because they are loaded, and this is certainly one that is loaded and evokes, evokes images of the I-395 at rush hour, and that's an unpleasant experience, and no one wants that. But this presupposes that a deregulatory environment is that rush hour, when, as opposed to a regulatory environment. And so I think we can, sort of appeals to discussion of what gridlock means. We need to get beyond that. I agree to have a frank discussion about what is desirable as a matter of policy. Now, with respect to the separation of powers issues that I'd like to eventually have us talk about, specifically the president's recess appointments, I want to address the basic question, which I think underlies all of this, is who does the separation of powers protect? I think it's an interesting claim, often made more especially by functionalists than by formalists. It's the claim that the separation of powers protects bargains that are struck by the branches of government, as the functionalist view. So if Congress should deem it over a lengthy period of time that it's willing to allow the president to get its way and make intra-session recess appointments, that ought to be permissible. My conception of the separation of powers, and I'd like to suggest the one that I think is the one we ought to follow, is that it's the separation of powers is not designed to protect particular office holders. It's designed to protect the people in the long run. And so the bargains that may be politically struck, that I as a senator may find it inconvenient to have to be around to confirm someone, and so therefore I'm more than happy to nod and wink to the 1920 opinion of Attorney General Dougherty and say, sure, yeah, we'll call this a recess. That I don't think that's the right approach. And I think to its credit, the SG's office is largely taking the tack, at least its principal arguments, though it does mention the executive acquiescence or legislative acquiescence argument, is actually one about let's look at what the text of the document actually means. And I think that's interesting, especially at a federal society event, because it suggests the influence that originalism now has on the court. Now, it helps, too, that this is a subject where there isn't all sorts of judicial precedent littering the field. But I would say that this is interesting that the SG's office of the Obama administration is speaking originalism, and I think that's significant. So with that, I'll just that's.
Do you, Caroline, do you have any rebuttals here? Because you may be a little bit outnumbered.
This is an interesting panel because it's so wide-ranging that it's sort of hard to know where to start. Perhaps I'm a functionalist to some extent. But I think using the language of originalism is natural, and we have several of the justices who may well respond to that. There's so much ambiguity in the language here, though, and I think many scholars have pointed out that the recess, a recess, it's really hard to draw a very strong argument about what the framers' intent was based on that. They also say the president and the Congress, but we surely know that there were going to be more than one of them and more than one Congress. So, I think it is something, though, that I think for this audience, it's just worth sort of thinking about, that we have presidents who've made over 500 intra-session appointments. President Bush made 171 recess appointments. And I think I have an interesting quote here from one of our favorite speakers at ACS, Randy Barnett, who in 2003 wrote in the National Journal, and this was, as you may recall, there were some filibusters of federal judges or nominees to the federal courts, including the D.C. Circuit, Miguel Estrada, Priscilla Owen, and some others. And Randy said, "The recess appointment power is the only threat that could force the Senate Democrats to budge. Our founders created the recess appointment power to assure that the judiciary could continue to function." I think you could put, you know, the executive branch in there. "If circumstances or political factions prevented advice and consent process from functioning effectively, recess appointments have impeccable historical pedigree, beginning with Washington. Presidents have made more than 300 recess appointments to Article III courts." And he, at that point, was sort of enamored with an idea of having what he called a judicial clerkship program for conservative and libertarian law professors. And he was suggesting that President Bush recess appoint Richard Epstein, Alex Kaczynski, Richard Posner. Some of them made it onto the court. Though I think he'd probably retract Richard Posner now, maybe even Alex Kaczynski. But he also recommended Edith Jones, who obviously also made it, and Robert Bork. Anyway, I say this to, you know, that there's been, you know, that the use of recess appointments, intra session recess appointments of vacancies that did not arise during a recess has been a not only a common practice recently, but stretching back through quite a bit of history. And I think, you know, we have to look at the situation that we're in. And I would just say, obviously, President Bush was faced a number of filibusters and used the recess appointment in numerous circumstances. I think we have to think about, you know, in terms of separation of powers, if we understand the language the way that the D.C. Circuit has understood it, in contravention of three other circuit courts, we're in a situation where the advice and consent power has given all the power to the Senate. And it has really eviscerated the ability of the president to make appointments. When you have this issue, when you have the filibuster, and you have no recess appointments, more or less, presidents are going to be totally hamstrung. I can't imagine that really is an originalist reading of our Constitution. I have not been immersed in the minutiae of decisions by the National Labor Relations Board, certainly in the last decade or more. But I would say, I think you could probably find many a union side labor lawyer who would point to many violations on the other side during the boards that existed during Republican administrations. I think, though, we have an issue here, which is about whether we want this, whether we should really go ahead and address whether we want the National Labor Relations Act to exist. And I have a quote here from Lindsey Graham in the blocking of the board appointments. Says, "I will continue to block all nominations to the NLRB. The NLRB, as inoperable, could be considered progress." So I think that, you know, that may be a position that is agreed with in this room. But I think then let's go for that. Let's do away with the National Labor Relations Board once and for all. Let's have a debate about it. But this is, I think, very destructive of our government and very destructive of the way our countrymen want our government to function.
If I can have a minute?
Yeah, briefly, yeah.
Sure. You know, the Constitution says during the recess of the Senate, so I think it's something different than when the term the president's made. There are only a few intra-session appointments prior to 1947. I think there are only four. And even then, you could argue that they really weren't intra-session appointments. Some administrations since 47 didn't name any. Kennedy, Ford, Johnson, I believe, named no intra-session recess appointments. So I don't know if it's all that necessary. Only one other circuit court really hit the issue. That was the 11th Circuit, and one was kind of suggested. It was kind of bent in favor of a colleague that it was trying to support, who was recess appointed to the 11th Circuit. On Lindsey Graham's comment, I think it was regrettable, but you have to put it in context with what the Obama board had done. The disdain for process was startling. Issuing a quick election rule on the vote of two members, telling the member who was going to dissent that he could issue a personal statement later. It changed literally decades and decades of longstanding board law, all of which was to favor unionization and not to be neutral on it. I believe in the National Labor Relations Act. I think the National Labor Relations Act could be amended. Perhaps they do need to be civil market penalties.
yet you're going to have a balanced board before you start imposing penalties. So the question is not the National Labor Relations Act. And again, I think Lindsey Graham's comment was regrettable. But again, I think if you put it in context with what he was saying, he's saying, I'd rather the board do nothing right now than what it has done over the last year and a half. Also, keep in mind, 90% of the board's work, or the agency work, goes forward with or without.
I do have to say, it's a little hard to object to the process violation of only issuing decisions with only two members, and then saying it's okay for the Republicans to hold up other people from being appointed. You can't really have it both ways. Either you're going to have the process because there are going to be enough members to actually operate under the quorum as decided fairly recently by the Supreme Court.
Well, and Harry Reid invented the pro forma session. So, I mean, it becomes a question of discretion for me, but not for thee, right? So, I mean, the Immigration and Nationality Act exists, but as an act of prosecutorial discretion, the president carves out vast classes of individuals and, you know, the dreamers. There's a tit for tat. I think what we could probably agree on, and I got the sense that there was some agreement earlier, was that we don't like the idea of moving the goalposts in the middle of the game. And I think that's important, because I think that it is easier to see the partisan mote in your neighbor's eye than the beam in your own, to put it one way. And so I think it commendable that Michael Rappaport, a member of the Federalist Society, professor at University of San Diego, conservative Republican, OLC alum, he wrote the seminal article in 2005 during the Bush administration saying that the way we have interpreted the recess appointments clause is incorrect. And by the way, it's against my partisan interest. I think that to the extent that we can look at the original meaning and take seriously the idea that the Constitution has a fixed, knowable meaning, even if we may disagree about the evidence, then at least that cabins the debate a little bit. And here we're not talking about sort of the prosaic generalities of the Constitution. What does it mean, privileges or immunities? What does it mean, equal protection of the law or due process? The recess appointments clause is more in the nature of a rule. It's going to turn on whether we think the was really meant to be a definite article, or whether we're going to give it a reading that it was somehow an indefinite article. And so I think that we can come to some agreement on the desirability of a clear rule. And then I would add to that I don't want to distort the Constitution's interpretation simply because of the filibuster. I would agree with you and with Alan Morrison that probably what needs to happen is that if this is what's driving it, is a head-on confrontation with the filibuster in the Senate. Because I do think elections have consequences. As a matter of policy, I think the filibuster might have some merits. I question some constitutional issues with respect to it, but let's not distort the recess appointments clause because of the filibuster.
If I could ask a first question, and then we'll be ready for questions from anyone here, and including on other topics if you want to bring up the posting regulation by NLRB, the criminal background check by EEOC, and other things like that. We're open to other topics. But since I cover the court, it seems clear that their conference of the 20th, on the 20th, is going to have the NLRB recess appointments before it. It seems clear that they're going to accept the case, probably announce that on the 24th. Let's advance that by a year. Do we think that we're looking at is this an obvious 5-4 decision by the court? What sort of considerations do you think will go into this case, and how do you think it will come out, anyone, in any order?
Well, I would just say briefly, I think it's hard to say, because you may have tensions that and liberties that don't run in quite the expected directions we expect them to go. You know, for example, some conservative members of the court very much favor a strong executive. I continue to think that there is not a clear reading of the recess clause, and practice does have some influence, especially longstanding practice and how it affects the ability to run the government. So I don't know. I mean, I actually think 5-4 is certainly one possibility, but I don't know if it's the 5 that we expect.
Right.
I agree with Caroline. It's a difficult call, but if I was asked to call it, I think the court will agree with what the numbers will be. I
agree with the D.C. Circuit, perhaps not on the second issue. I think it'll agree on what that on the intercession issue. It may not agree as to whether or not the recess had to arise during the intercession.
And could they, Tuan, maybe you know the answer to this, could they also not even address that, as the Third Circuit, I think, didn't address
right.
that?
Right. I think part of it will turn on how and bonus what issues they grant cert on. And the respondent, Canning, had proposed the following question. Let me read it. So whether the President's recess appointment power may be exercised when the Senate is convening every 3 days in pro forma sessions. And so that was the third question that they proposed in addition to the two the government had. And I had no idea. I'd given up on reading tea leaves. I'm still recovering from Sibelius. So.
Why don't we go to questions?
I called that one. Oh. I was on the O'Reilly factor.
Congratulations.
I called it on the tax return.
Terrific.
Questions from the audience? Anyone? Oh, come on.
Well, can I just maybe
sure.
speak to Tuan's point about the filibuster? Because I think we could find some agreement there. I, if you bother to look at my biography, there's no reason you should have. You will find that I did work on the Hill for a number of years, which was most of my career was spent in the Senate. I worked for Tom Daschle. I worked in the Clinton White House in the Legislative Affairs Office working on judges, and then I was Chief of Staff to Maria Cantwell. For 4 years, and during that time was the Maria Cantwell time, especially was when there were a lot of filibusters of Bush Circuit Court nominees, and I do think that you know over time there is a little bit about you know the partisan mote in your eye, as you probably expressed it more articulately, but you know I think that when you step back from this process and you think about how we really like to. Both protect the president's power to appoint with the advice and consent of the Senate, obviously, but to have a certain amount of leeway during an election. We need to really think about whether the filibuster itself is due for some kind of major reform. And we were talking here earlier, and I was relating a story about another conservative I debated recently about the D.C. Circuit, but we both agreed after our debate was over that if we could sort of be behind a curtain, in the Rawlsian kind of sense, we would, you know, design a very different system, I think. And I think the time now is ripe to really look at the filibuster and whether or not there needs to be, perhaps not abolishing it altogether, but certainly some kind of reform that doesn't allow for the type of obstruction that's been going on recently.
I would only part company with Caroline when she says the type of obstruction that's been going on recently. I think the obstruction during the Bush administration was startling. Look at Estrada, highly qualified. The only reason he didn't get to the circuit court was because he was Hispanic, and the fear that he would be a Republican Hispanic on the Supreme Court. Now that is really not the kind of conduct we should extol by any means, not to suggest that you are. I did want to say one thing when you mentioned two members. You know, Wilma Leib and I, when I was chairman, made the decision to issue decisions as a two-member board. We had a legal opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel saying we had the authority, with a little footnote saying, now that you have asked for our opinion, we expect you to follow it. We didn't have to follow it. But I'm just saying it was a fairly strongly worded letter. And we went ahead, but you know, the dynamics were very, very different. I am a conservative. My background was a labor neutral. I was an arbitrator. Wilma is a liberal progressive. Her background is a union labor lawyer. We had sparred over the years, both in public and in decisions, on different views back and forth on labor law. So kind of people kind of said, you know, if you could get Schomburg and Liebman to agree to a decision, well, you're not going to do any better. And so the dynamic, and also we agreed that we were going to apply existing board law. So the entire dynamics are very different than what's going on now, because the current three members all are well known to have strong union sympathies. And they are issuing decisions without any limitations whatsoever. They really came out with an unfortunate press release within hours of the D.C. Circuit decision. decision that never should have issued. It was kind of brazen, which is kind of set the stage. But they didn't limit their decision-making authority. They could have. They could have said that they're not going to issue any decisions which further controversial decisions of the prior Obama board. But instead, they have issued three-member decisions that have furthered the controversial decisions of the Obama board. So it's an entirely different thing that's going on. And of course, we didn't have a D.C. Circuit decision out of the box saying that we didn't have authority. I think the breakdown was four circuits agreed with this. The Fifth Circuit did not, which is the D.C. Circuit, and its decision wasn't issued until about four circuit decisions later.
Questions? Yeah, right here.
Yeah, there is a case pending in U.S. District Court here, I guess, captioned by Common Cause versus Biden, challenging the constitutionality of filibusters. Obviously, there are no senators who are parties to it. There are four or five members of the House who have joined. Are you familiar with the case? Do you
a little
think
bit.
That's going to have any?
I think it's been dismissed already.
Has it been dismissed?
Not yet, from lack of standing.
Well, I think that's why they got members of Congress involved in trying to overcome the standing
issue. I don't think it was actually.
I don't know that worked.
Well, I mean, it was interesting. I think Tuan and I, mean, I don't know if we have the same point of view on this. I don't think that there's necessarily an argument to be made that the filibuster is unconstitutional. But I think it's certainly not something that serves us well in the way, you know, at the extremes. And I won't deny that there certainly were filibusters during the Bush administration that many thought went too far. But as to whether it's unconstitutional, I think it's a hard argument to make. It's certainly not required that there be a filibuster by the Constitution. So their main argument was that the Constitution explicitly lays out when you have supermajority requirements, and it does not in this case. And so therefore, implicitly, it's unconstitutional. And I think that's a bit of a hard argument to make.
Just because something is unconstitutional doesn't mean it's justiciable. Mm-hmm. And so something could be unconstitutional and non-justiciable, in which case it's the Senate that has to clean up its own mess. And I think that's probably the case with the filibuster law. When I mentioned that I thought there were some difficulties with respect to the filibuster legally, I didn't mean to suggest anyone could go to court and have a remedy about that. I just mean simply that senators take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I would agree that there is some good evidence in the Constitution, though scholars have disagreed on the characterization, that the vice president's power, for example, to cast votes in tied cases, right? This is undermined if you have supermajority rules. At the very least, it recognizes that the default rule is majority rules, except for those explicitly mentioned departures in the document. So, is it useful to talk about it? I think the filibuster is probably useful because we don't want the houseification of the Senate. I think the Senate ought to play a different function than the House. It ought to be more deliberative. Now that it's directly elected, just like the House, since the Oregon plans became popular in the 17th Amendment, I think we're trying to fight against it just moving in partisan lockstep. I think bicameralism is also a feature and not a flaw. And so I would like for it to be distinct. But is it too easy to filibuster now? I think it is. I think that, for example, parliamentary tracking with respect to the filibuster lowers the cost for any given senator to filibuster anything. And so I think that you should make someone be strong Thurmond, right, and hold the floor for 24 hours, 10 minutes, or however long it was, and make it a costly endeavor so people do think twice what they're really willing to go to the mat on.
And that's one of the reforms that is being discussed is the talk of filibuster, which I actually think would also be very edifying for people to actually understand what the debate was about, rather than having an endless quorum call in the Senate.
We may have agreement. We may have agreement on that.
Was that not what Rand Paul went through?
He did, right, but he didn't have to, right?
Right.
So
that was. Right.
Constant gridlock, nothing gets done. most of that is because of Senate filibusters or the threat of filibusters. If that disappears, gridlock disappears, somebody's got to sit down and vote. You got 51 votes, you win. You can win the next election on the other side. You can overturn their decision, if not get a new president, who will sign it into law. But as long as that exists, whoever's doing it, you are institutionalizing gridlock, and nobody wants to be the first one to say, all right, we're going to stop. Everybody says the other side should stop first. So it only gets worse. It will never get better.
But is gridlock bad necessarily? I mean, what's wrong with gridlock if the other side is trying to do something which is highly controversial? Doesn't the filibuster more assure some degree of temperance on one side?
Yeah. You've got Obamacare, and a lot of people would like to see it repealed. But you may need 60 votes to get it repealed, even though you need only 51 to get it passed, because that will be filibustered. If everybody's got to play by the same rules and it takes 51 votes.
I personally am willing to live with that. I'm willing to live with that. I oppose it. And I oppose the manner in which Obamacare was passed, which again, was unfortunate. But, if it's totally, I'm willing to live with Obamacare before we do a filibuster. One thing I don't recall, maybe it's my age, did we have a similar debate over doing away with the filibuster or changing it during the Bush administration?
Yes.
Was it?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, the Federalist Society has several papers up still on its website about why judicial nominations, filibusters of judicial nominations, are unconstitutional. I could produce reams of quotes from Orrin Hatch and John Cornyn and Mitch McConnell, et cetera, talking about how the filibuster should be done away with. So yes, it's the other shoes on the other foot. It's been the same debate. That's for the nuclear option.
I was too busy at the NLRB.
As the libertarian on the panel, I'll agree with Carolyn on this, right? So Dimblegut wrote an article that was published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy on the so-called nuclear option. But again, I think Peter's right on this issue about gridlock. To grant that as a term of debate is to grant the idea that it's undesirable, because of the negative associations of gridlock. And so gridlock is often the metaphor invoked by those who favor pro-regulatory regime, because, it's hard to get things done, and getting things done means the legislature is acting, which is typically not to repeal statutes, as you imagine, with Obamacare, but instead to create even more of them. And so if you don't grant the metaphor, then it falls apart.
If you have less gridlock in Congress, do you have less of a reason for the types of decisions we're seeing out of a lot of the agencies, the NLRB, the EEOC? Do you have less reason for executive actions and executive orders out of the White House? And is that good or is that bad?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, potentially, yes. I mean, there's certainly presidents have been known to use other powers when they can't get legislation passed. This is a longstanding activity in Washington, but I think we could hypothesize that might be the case, although I don't know. Presidents like to use their powers, as we know.
It's a difficult question to answer. It's a broad one. When it comes to the, I'm sorry, did someone ask a question? It's probably.
Yeah, we have a couple more questions going on. Let me go to the back, and then I'll come back up here. Way back there. Yep.
On the point about the president trying to legislate in different ways, thinking about this, we had a proposal called the Employee Free Choice Act. And the Employee Free Choice Act, through a compromise or an agreement that was made, was put on the back burner so that ACA could become the primary focus of the administration. And EFCA was going to come later. Well, the House flipped, and that was the end of EFCA. And one of the reasons why I think there is so much feelings towards what this board is doing is because many people believe that this board is really trying to legislate, and legislate a good deal of what EFCA attempted to do, coupled with what the Department of Labor is about to do with the persuader regulation. So it's not so much that I have a question, but just an observation, because I think it also relates to the opening discussion that we had. And that is, there's this fourth branch, and in the aspect of the labor board, it's not really accountable to anybody because it's an independent agency, that is really trying to craft an agenda that should have been discussed in the legislature, but wasn't. And I would welcome a robust discussion about amending the National Labor Relations Act. For example, I've been on the record saying I think there ought to be 7 board members, and, you know, one term and different ways of rotating and things of that nature. But I think that there has been this very, very strong visceral reaction from many people about what this board is doing, because they really see quickie elections, specialty health care, et cetera, as really legislating in the name of regulating.
Well, Michael, I agree with you, but I'm in favor of a neutral board. We're supposed to be a neutral board. How do we get there? You know, I've suggested to the board's power should go to the federal judiciary. Should there be, if Wilma and I, we had to reach agreement, or a case didn't issue. We issued 600 decisions. We issued 90% of the cases brought to us for decision. We couldn't deal with the big issues because we disagreed with them. But should there be lifetime appointments? Arlen Specter interviewed Wilma and I, and one of the issues he raised, and she looked at me and looked at him, and she said, "You mean life sentences?" But I mean, I don't know how you deal with it, but I do think we have to have a neutral board, and we don't have a neutral board. Now, you know, people say, "Oh, the Bush administration wasn't a neutral board." You know, there's truth to that, to only to the extent that I think a management attorney, as a union side attorney, is limited by their experiences. But there are different pressures on the union side attorney than the management side attorney. There are thousands of employers. It doesn't really matter. You know, you'll get your clients. On the union side, there aren't all that many unions. And the unions do not like it when you issue a decision that they don't like. So there are different pressures, but that would be a good debate. How do you get to a neutral board? How can you amend the act to do it? A variety of proposals have been made.
I think there are many on the left who would also welcome, you know, getting back to discussion of EFCA. I think many of us think that the National Labor Relations Act is actually way too weak in terms of enabling workers to organize, that employers have such an ability to thwart organizing give their speeches, and unions have very limited opportunity to reach workers themselves. So I think that would be a great discussion. I think it is definitely a statute that's seen as flawed on both sides.
Anything that hasn't been modernized when it's 70-some-odd years old sort of speaks for itself. But I think that these are honest discussion points, as opposed to these proxy wars that all of this litigation has really going on, and these visceral attacks that management doesn't want a board. Management does want a board. They want a neutral board. And I think people do want a modern National Labor Relations Act.
I've read Peter's piece in Roll Call on actually giving the work of the NLRB to the judiciary, and I think that would be preferable also.
It would be an easy answer. I don't see how anyone can argue about having a neutral board. I think organized labor would like to see it. But maybe some on the management side would like to see it.
Well, we need to review to have the 5-member board then, when you have 3 members of one party and 2 of the other. So I think by definition you're going to have a president is going to appoint people that he or she, hopefully in the future, will find more in tune with her position.
That's absolutely correct. But you know, there was a time when the Congress said it anticipated, you know, neutral government employees, and we don't have that now. And there are pressures brought to bear on board members, particularly unions on board members. They may not be they are expressed before organized labor makes quite clear it expects Democrats on the board to serve its interests.
We only have about 10 minutes, and I see 2 hands in the back. We had one here first, and then I'll get to the 2 back there. Go ahead.
I'm Ray Lajeunesse. I'm Vice President, Legal Director for the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. You mentioned the notice posting case. We were one of the plaintiffs in that case, in which the D.C. Circuit held that the notice posting rule which requires all employers to post a notice about the unionized, violates the act. Two questions. One, comment, if you want, on the merits of the case. And secondly, do you have any insight as to whether the board will seek cert in that case?
I don't. On your latter question, I skimmed through this circuit court decision. It was dense. I agree with it. You could have dealt with the notice posting rule in a number of different ways. The U.S. District Court in South Carolina said the board was without authority. I think the big mistake the board made was to make the notice such a partisan notice, such a one-sided notice. And when you read the comments that were submitted by management asking that, you know, the employee's right to oppose the union, the employee's right not to pay union, full union dues be made express, and the answers which were given by the board majority, it was really chilling to me when I saw the answers. They just weren't valid. But had they hadn't had such a partisan notice, the case may have come out differently.
If I could just say briefly, I mean, I think it's an interesting decision. It's problematic, I think, because it raises, based on the sort of broad free speech basis, it raises questions about, and perhaps you would agree with this, should an employer have be required to post health and safety notices or employment notices about making sure there's no discrimination in the workplace, to the point of, do they have to mark where the exits are? I mean, so how broad is that decision? I think it's troubling in the way that it's framed. I haven't gotten into the nuances of exactly how the board issued that decision, but I think, and I probably disagree with you on this, I think it's important for employees to be informed of their basic rights in the workplace. But the breadth of that decision, I think, raises many questions.
Yeah, we had in the middle here, and then I'll go back into the corner of it.
On the idea of turning the board's functions over to the federal courts, well, wouldn't that just be going back to what it was before the Wagner Act? I mean, you had a federal law of labor relations, and the whole reason you had a National Labor Relations Board was the argument that the courts were biased against unions, that they had been developed a law that was unfriendly to unions. And you had to, the whole point for pro-union people was to get those issues out of the courts and into some body that was, in the original Wagner Act, frankly, pro-union.
Well, you know, I think there's a difference with lifetime appointments. I have to go back now, prior to the Wagner Act, I wasn't born at that time. But I think that the dynamics, again, were different. These terms pro-union and pro-management, I really don't like them because there's something behind all of it. It could be, you know, a real constitutional basis for something which is described all of a sudden as pro-management or the like. But I think the federal judiciary, however we get there, it doesn't have to be the federal judiciary. We have to try to assure a neutral board. I don't know how you do it without giving it to an entity which has a reputation for neutrality, even if it isn't always that neutral.
Good. Just two quick responses. So first, it's clear that whoever's ox is being gored, that is, whoever favors the status quo is going to be opposed to any sort of departure. And so I don't know much about the NLRB except the few things I've read and the characterization that it's union captured. And so if that's the case, I don't know, then we could expect unions would not be that happy with Peter's proposal and roll call. The second point, though, would be that whenever you have a repeat player specialty court, the repeat player specialty courts are going to attract the single issue advocates, both because they've got the expertise and the interest and the aligned interests on particular issues. And so to the extent that you can get away from the specialty judiciary, so if you just had an Article III abortion court, you know what the judges would look like on that court. And if you had an Article III labor court, we know that they're going to be staunchly, well, the Federal Circuit in terms of intellectual property, right? So you could take any of these. So to the extent you give this to a general expertise court, then I think that it's not a question of, will they sometimes be biased? Yes, as the judiciary sometimes might have been more conservative, sometimes more liberal, yes. But will it be less biased than, say, an entity that is stocked full of partisans on either side of the issue? I think Peter's proposal has some merit.
Let me go back to the corner here.
Yeah, I was wondering whether or not whether we would get a different dynamic with some of these issues if the NLRB decided to make more policy decisions through rulemaking rather than making them as it has historically in the context of individual adjudications. I mean, that would both slow the ability of succeeding NLRBs to reverse prior decisions, give more predictability to both management and unions, and perhaps allow greater discussion of the broader policy consequences of different types of rules.
I have no objection to more rulemaking. The problem is that circumstances change, and it is difficult to change a rule. So, you know, there are kind of pluses and minuses to it. Certainly, I think the dynamics will be different. But look at the dynamics with the quickie election rule. When you look at the manner in which it was proposed, I termed it in almost star chamber fashion. You know, the board didn't deliberate amongst themselves. It couldn't have, because if they deliberated amongst themselves, they would have had to comply with the Sunshine Act and notice a public meeting. So you had two members of the board presumably communicating through staff with a third. They didn't communicate with their Republican colleague at all. So there are real problems with rulemaking also.
We have probably time for one more, if there is one more. Otherwise, let me ask for any wrap-up comments from the panel here. Caroline, did you want to jump back in as the liberal on the panel?
No, I mean, I think we haven't been touching on any of the red meat points for the last few questions, so I don't really have anything to react to, except just to say it's been enjoyable, and thank you all for having me.
Invite everybody to the ACS conference.
Everybody should come to the ACS conference, where we have more interesting discussions like this one.
Well, thank you very much for attending. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.